Budget vote speech, which will take place on the 25th of May this year, and that day is of course Africa Day. So there is some sense of thoroughness in terms of looking into detail as we look at the presentation that will be made by Dr. Mthembu, as well as the presentation that will be made by the Director General. Let us also take this opportunity to congratulate Mr. Mavoy, who was the Acting Director General of the Department of International Relations, who has now been appointed by Cabinet as the Director General. Shall we congratulate him? We wish you all of the success in your work to serve both the department and the people of South Africa in general. In fact, in this position, you are a very strategic and an important link, even for the African continent as well as the world, because you are not just dealing with the country only, and most probably you are a very important anchor to the ministry. Congratulations. We want to say to the department, Deputy Minister, that since the departure or the redeployment of the previous PLO, we've cut off the link between the department and the committee, and that we request that the department comes to us in due course to indicate who is the new PLO, or at least officially to indicate the name and the contact details of the person who will be acting, so that whatever communication we are able to deal with that person into the department. There's been an issue that has been before us for quite some time, which is the study tour on the Foreign Service Bill. I was invited by the Chair of Committees, Honorable Frolic, to say that the budget of the Speaker's office has been cut from, if I remember well, from 52 million to 45 million, and therefore that he is unable, not unwilling, unable to approve our study tour to Germany and China, and that we needed to choose one country. Now, in view of the fact that Germany has a legislation, remember that we looked at a number of countries that have got legislation, one of which was Germany, and a number of countries that are using their codes and practices, one of which was China. We needed to compare among those that have legislation and among those that don't have. And the trip to Germany, the date was the 17th of June. So we are going to recommend to him. We've withdrawn after the discussion between myself and him. We have withdrawn the application. We'll only indicate that we'll be going to Germany. And so the committee secretary will be looking at the budget for that. What Frolic has done, he has taken away and he has also given something, taken away one of the countries, that we're supposed to visit. But he also says if we take one country, the entire committee will be allowed to travel to that country. So in all likelihood, but I don't know what the final recommendation will be, the entire committee is likely to travel to Germany to go and look at their foreign service legislation. And if that happens, it means all the parties, all the members will be present. And I think that will be very good. And we think that we should not disturb the date which has been set for Germany. So we should right away go to Germany, come back somewhere 24, 25. And yeah, so that's the announcement that I wanted to bring to the attention of the members. Now, there are people who must speedily deal with certain things. The committee secretary, I should be able to sign off the new application for Germany, if I could do that before Friday, regarding the rearranged budget. Everything else, the flights and all other ground transport, everything else remains the same. And also the department, which following the application must then firm up this thing with the ambassador that a delegation will be coming and the purpose for which it will be coming. I think that takes care of a few things that we needed to share with this leadership. With that, once again, welcome Deputy Minister after a short recess. We want to humbly and respectfully defer to you for whatever few remarks, if there are any, but the person who's going to lead a discussion is an analysis of South Africa's foreign policy, and that will be Dr. Philani Mthembu. So you will hear what observations, what advice, what weaknesses, what strengths, what areas he will focus on regarding how we've been doing our work over within this financial year. Can we hear you if there is anything to that? If there are no remarks or if there's nothing from the Deputy Minister, of course. Over to you. Oh yes. I'm being advised that I'm jumping the gun. Yes, can we hear apologies, please?
Thank you, Chair. I only have one apology, Chair, from Honorable Kalyan. She's at the Pan-African Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Who?
Honorable S. Kalyan, Chair.
Yes. What about Dudley? No apology? Okay. Hi, man, I'm busy, guys. I'm from Mulwane. He's the eldest here. No, I think those will be joining us shortly, I would imagine. Yes, we also want to welcome the presence of Ambassador Nkosi, who is the COO of the department. Babu Nkosi, most welcome. I like the fact that ambassadors keep their titles for life. And I was wondering whether at home, wives should not be compelled to call you ambassador to be ambassador masango. Abanyikubo baba. Yes, most welcome. Thank you very much, Deputy Minister.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee and Honorable members of this Portfolio Committee. Chairperson and committee members, I'm leading a delegation that will do the hard work. Our DG, as Chairperson said already, who's been recently confirmed by the Cabinet, DG Mohai, our COO, who's also a confirmed COO, Ambassador Ngosi, and the CFO, Mr. Ramashau. But we also have a privilege of having Mr. Kotse, who's CD Planning, the head of ARF, ARF Secretariat, Ms. Masako, and the monitoring and planning for ARF. Basiteri. Okay. Okay.
Nothing with a new DG.
Okay.
DG?
Do you want me to? That's our DG. Yes. And that's our COO. No, COO. Ambassador Ngosi. That's our CFO, Mr. Ramashawe. Ms. Kotsie. Planning, okay. Masako. And Basiteri. 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 Not bad. Oi, Bell. We make it toss. Basiteri.
Basiteri,
yes. Yes. But Chairperson, let me take this opportunity to express our sincere appreciation to the Portfolio Committee for giving us this opportunity. We are here to deliver the Department's annual performance plan for 2017-2018, as well as the African Renaissance Fund annual plans for the same year. We place much value to the Portfolio Committee for the support it has given us over the years. Together we have worked as a collective to deliver on the mandate bestowed on us by our people. We are quite aware that yours is an important mandate to make sure that executive is held accountable to this institution and the people of South Africa. We value the continued guidance and constructive criticism. We look forward to strengthening our cooperation in the current financial year, and also tell us when we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. I believe that the two presentations will provide the committee with an overview of our work. Mindful of the financial challenges we face, our department is committed to do more with less. And due to South Africa's growing global stature, our country's international relations, engagement, and responsibilities continue to increase accordingly. In the past year, we have achieved a number of strategic objectives through our binational commissions and other binational mechanisms and economic diplomacy. This has been at the forefront, no, economic diplomacy has been at the forefront of South Africa's foreign engagement. We believe in this approach to international relations as it fosters better security and friendship among countries and people. It also helps us domestically to further our national targets as shown in a number of key policy imperatives. This for me is particularly important to addressing the triple challenges of poverty, inequality and unemployment here at home. Honorable Chair and members, however contradictory it may sound, please allow me to brag with some humility about South Africa's growing role in international organizations. Later this year, South Africa will assume the role of chair of three very significant international bodies, namely BRICS, IORA, as well as the regional one, SADC. This demonstrates the weight of South Africa globally. We are aware of the cost of being the chair, but we are committed to make the most to benefit from it locally. I hope these few remarks, I was able to give you an overview of what informs our international relation engagement and to emphasize the importance of this committee to work that we do abroad and to express our wish to continue the necessary relationship of critical appraisal between the legislature and the executive. Please allow me, Honorable Chairperson, to invite our Director General, DG Mohai, recently appointed by Cabinet, to deliver the department's annual performance plans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Well, it will not happen at this stage. He will do so later after Dr. Tembo has walked us through the analysis. I want to apologize for omitting an item here, which is the adoption of the agenda. I'm very sorry about that. Of course, with the announcement that I've already made under the welcoming remarks, can I hear the members on the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Raputi, the person of.
Yes, Chair. I'm moving for the adoption of the agenda.
Is there anyone who is violently opposed to the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Kota, I want to hear you on whether we do adopt or we are violently.
It was moved by the second.
We are seconding Raputi. Thank you very much. And it was imposed on you. Your hand was not up. Thank you very much, Honorable Kota. With that, let's invite Dr. Mtembu to make a presentation. Bow.
Thank you, colleagues. It's always an honor to be in front of the committee and to be able to present some of the ongoing research that we are busy with related to South Africa's foreign policy, but also just global politics in general. What I'll do, which is what I usually do, I have all my presentation here on my laptop, but you know, I'll present it in such a way that it's very clear to committee members, but at the same time, I'll ensure that committee members do have a copy of this and also just some of the graphs that I've used for this particular analysis. And I thought, well, firstly, it given that the department will be presenting the actual plan, I should focus rather on thematic areas and give an overview on some of those thematic areas in this changing global political environment. I just start, you know, by giving a basic a comparison in terms of there's two graphs that I used in just recent research. The recent research that we've been doing is just basically comparing the material capabilities of states and comparing that with their levels of human development on the African continent. The assumption there is that there's a changing economic and political balance within the continent, and you know, so we wanted to see, you know, to what extent is that reflected in the data. When I say material national capabilities, here I mainly refer to three categories that states possess in terms of material resources. The first category is basically the traditional international relations aspects of military capabilities. So here you look at the size of the military personnel, but then you also look at national budgets on the military. The second, you look at energy as an indicator, and that's the intensity within which, you know, energy is consumed within those particular states. And then the third category is demographics, and demographics here, yeah, it's the overall population, but additionally it's the size also of the urban population. So we thought, let's contrast, you know, countries which are seen to be materially strong within the continent of Africa, which possess those resources in high quantities, and compare them with countries which are doing relatively well in terms of their human development index, because it's not an automatic assumption that states that are that possess material capabilities are able to translate those into benefits for their citizens. I just go through it briefly in terms comparing 2007 and 2012. These are African nation states in the order of what I say strategic importance. But essentially, I'm saying strategic importance, and I'm using it synonymously with, do they possess material capabilities? Countries that are important in terms of their material capabilities include Egypt, Nigeria, South Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, Algeria, Morocco, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Angola. Now, these are countries, you know, that have these three categories in large quantities. If we compare those countries with countries which are actually doing well in terms of the human development index, countries that are doing well in terms of the human development index are countries, 2015 data, such as the Seychelles, Mauritius, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya still outperforms despite the political turmoil, Botswana, Gabon, Egypt, and South Africa. These are countries that score highly in terms of the human development index on the continent. Now, if we take that further and we compare countries that are performing well in terms of the material capabilities they have, and countries that are doing well in terms of their human development, it's clear there that, you know, while, let's say in the top five, for instance, top five in terms of material capabilities are Egypt, Nigeria, South Africa, Congo, and Algeria. However, top five in terms of human development, it's Seychelles, Mauritius, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya. In the 2015 index, the Human Development Index, South Africa comes in at number 9 when it comes to Human Development Index within the continent. And then when it comes to material capabilities, it comes in at number 3 on the continent. So it's just to show that, I mean, it's not always, you know, a case. I mean, you look at countries like Mauritius, the Seychelles, these are small states, but, you know, even though they can't necessarily outperform South Africa in terms of the material capabilities that we possess, but they are doing relatively well in terms of their human development index. But let me just start, you know, there with that broad overview. My focus there, and I'll go through it, you know, I won't take too long, it's on South Africa's foreign policy priorities in 2017 and beyond. And I'll just give an overview here. Well, firstly, I mean, South Africa has a big global footprint. I mean, a country of our size it's still actually quite amazing the amount of footprint that we have globally. I mean, we have 126 diplomatic missions abroad and over 160 foreign representative offices in South Africa. Outside of Washington, essentially the whole world is in South Africa, and that is something that is significant, and it's something that remains significant. Obviously, that also raises question marks amongst various scholars as to whether a country of our size, you know, should necessarily have 126 diplomatic missions, or whether there are ways of using those particular resources in a different way, and maybe, you know, more strategic. Because I think one of those 126 diplomatic missions, I think they're stationed in about 107 countries or so. So obviously that raises also question marks. I mean, this is not something that's resolved. In the literature, you have those who are for and those who are against. But South Africa, what you cannot deny is that South Africa does have a global footprint. In fact, much, much bigger than countries which are bigger than us. Then I categorize my presentation in terms of the African agenda, South-South cooperation, North-South relations, maritime security and the ocean economy, participatory foreign policy making, development diplomacy, international trade and economic diplomacy, and then coordination of foreign engagements amongst the different spheres of government. And the last one is just an administrative point. And obviously I won't go into too much detail, but it's just to give, you know, an overview on these particular categories. The first one is on the African agenda. As Deputy Minister said, South Africa chairs in 2017 the SADC, and that is obviously something that is significant in terms of South Africa's goals within the African agenda. But what is also important there is the extent to which South Africa uses its chairing of SADC to continue making progress on the tripartite free trade area and prioritizing the tripartite free trade area. And now we know it was launched in 2015, and then the African Union also decided in Johannesburg during 2015 to negotiate the launch of the Continental Free Trade Area and conclude negotiations actually in 2017. So, I mean, this is obviously a significant issue for the work of the committee in terms of, you know, following up on where things currently stand with both the Tripartite Free Trade Area and with the Continental Free Trade Area, especially because, you know, on record, the Continental Free Trade Area, at least the negotiations, should make significant progress in 2017. And obviously South Africa can also use its position within the SADC to influence that process. Also within the African agenda, you have Agenda 2063, but significant, I think, there is the whole issue which we are you know, rapidly moving closer to a deadline, is the whole issue of silencing the guns by 2020. You know, where do things currently stand? If not throughout the continent, but within our immediate region, you know, how have we made progress in terms of meeting that goal of silencing the guns by 2020? And obviously, there's a number of positives to say in that area, but there's also a number of challenges. You know, it's global politics is in constant flux, so things are constantly changing, and I think you know, then it becomes obviously important for the committee to see to what extent we are actually making progress in this particular area, because it's a critical aspect of our African agenda. South Africa was also elected to the AU Peace and Security Council. Firstly, from the period 2014 to 2016, but also additionally from 2016 to 2018. So our position within the AU Peace and Security Council is obviously quite strategic in also meeting that previous goal of silencing the guns on the continent. So, you know, these are obviously areas that this committee will obviously need to follow up on in terms of how are we using our role within the African Union Peace and Security Council to actually meet these goals within our African agenda. Steps to ensure continental self-reliance in funding the African Union's programs and projects. That is a significant focus also, and it's something that was also elevated under Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma at the AU Commission. So there's several reports that came out and initiatives that came out which really said we need to really make practical steps in making sure that the African Union and its programs can be self-financed, and that we're finding innovative ways to finance these programs. Because obviously, we know that a majority of the funding that's going into these programs is coming from the donor countries. The EU plays a significant role over there. The US is also, you know, also contributes, and recently countries such as China are also, you know, putting money into the AU programs. But overwhelmingly, the funding still comes from the European Union. And obviously, if we are to talk about, you know, not just national sovereignty, but continental sovereignty, then these are very significant programs. Obviously, there's the Kagame reports that also came out. But essentially, these are things that come from within the AU, but also we've seen them, you know, we've seen them as an integral part of Agenda 2063. Also, the meeting that took place in Addis Ababa in 2016, the Financing for Development meeting, but also the Sustainable Development Goals. Finding ways to finance development is increasingly important, especially when we look at what's happening globally. I mean, Trump has talked about slashing foreign aid, you know, and not just slashing it, but also militarizing foreign aid. So it's quite clear that moving ahead, you know, it doesn't make sense to continually rely on the donors to continually fund these particular programs. Also, an important aspect within South Africa's African agenda is Morocco's re-entry into the African Union and the implications that this has for South Africa's diplomacy on the continent and, of course, the future of the Sahrawi Republic. Now, we saw, obviously, that 39 members of the African Union voted to readmit Morocco into the African Union. This was not necessarily a position that South Africa was in favor of. But I think these dynamics tell us also that the political landscape on the continent continues to change, and that we as scholars but who are practitioners also of international relations, we have to understand that the ground on the African continent is moving, and we need to be you know, constantly aware of where things are changing and obviously adapt our strategies in order to meet our interests within the continent. So that's going to be a very significant aspect. We saw Morocco had a very offensive economic diplomacy strategy, which they've been implementing, you know, for several years now, and clearly, you know, it's gotten clear results. But obviously, you know, one mustn't see it as a zero-sum game. You know, it's easy to see it as also as a zero-sum game. You know, there might be pros, there might be cons in terms of Morocco's re-entry into the African Union, because it has implications, obviously, for issues of regional integration, about also just the way that the Maghreb Union actually works, which, you know, for several years has really been quite dysfunctional as a regional economic bloc. So, you know, there's various dynamics that are taking place, and I think we need to pay more attention to what Morocco is doing, but also what Morocco is trying to do. I mean, we saw recently that they were, you know, had ideas of even being a member of ECOWAS, for instance. I mean, if hypothetically that were to happen, then you're basically saying that the Maghreb Union should be kind of dysfunctional, you know, and so there's various implications here of Morocco's re-entry, and I think we just need to obviously keep a close eye on that. Peacekeeping commitments, obviously this is an important area of South Africa's African agenda, and the presence of South Africa there, you know, remains important, especially even if we see there's domestic imperatives which force the department, you know, to rethink some of these missions. But also, you know, there's obviously also cases where soldiers' lives are lost, you know. But I think, you know, on some of these issues, it's very important, obviously, for South Africa to remain committed as a peacekeeper within the continent, because if South Africa obviously withdraws that role, it creates a vacuum. It's not necessarily that others will not fill that vacuum. Other actors will fill that vacuum, and it becomes more difficult to re-enter a space that you've vacated. So peacekeeping, obviously, as a strategic area, especially, you know, that Central Africa and Southern Africa, that is absolutely important. In terms of South-South cooperation, I mean, we've got in 2017 also very significant developments taking place. We've got the launch of the BRICS New Development Bank, the African Regional Center. There, 2017 is very significant because that is the year that this regional center should, in fact, be launched. So the committee obviously can make follow-ups in terms of the progress of this of the regional center, but also what type of projects it's looking to fund. We saw that the headquarters of the BRICS New Development Bank, the first tranche of funds that they disbursed were in renewable energies, and that was a positive thing. I mean, all countries have received their loans, and it's in the area of renewable energies. So we need to see what this regional center will do, but also not just do for South Africa, but do for the African continent. Then we've got the BRICS summit in China in September. We need to know how are the preparations going for the BRICS summit. But also, I think what's important there is not to limit our focus on the state-to-state relations when it comes to this BRICS summit. There's a lot of work that's happened within the BRICS of trying to move engagements, you know, beyond state actors. You know, so if you look at things like the BRICS Academic Forum, you look at the role of think tanks, you look at the role of business, you look at civil society engagements. There's been quite a number of civil society engagements on BRICS and the G20. So it's important, because if this partnership is to obviously remain important and gain momentum of its own, it's clear that in any declaration, it's not implemented by the state only. You know, a lot of these declarations actually must be implemented by civil society. They must be implemented by business and other actors. So that's obviously going to be quite important moving into September this year. But also linking to the September BRICS summit is South Africa's presidency of BRICS in 2018. I know work has already, you know, started on different aspects, but it's very important, obviously, that, you know, we move into the presidency of 2018 quite smoothly. But there's also consolidation of issues within the BRICS, and not that, you know, every country which holds just brings new issues until you have a long list of commitments that you're not able to actually keep track of. So that's going to be quite important in terms of 2018. But also linking to that, I mean, 2018 we've got the BRICS presidency, but 2018 we've also got the FOCAC summit, the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, and we are currently co-chairs of the FOCAC. So South Africa can obviously use that that role quite strategically, because obviously it will now hand over its chairing of its co-chairing of the FOCAC summit, and that's taking place in 2018. So I think the committee, for instance, it's important for the committee to see to what extent the Johannesburg FOCAC summit outcomes, which were in December 2015, have been implemented. I mean, FOCAC usually has a good record in terms of implementing the commitments, but you know, obviously the committee can use its position, you know, to get answers in terms of how far we've come in implementing, but also how has not just the continent gained from those outcomes, but how South Africa itself has also gained, because obviously South Africa received quite a bit of funding as part of those commitments. Let me move over to North-South relations. South Africa signed the Economic Partnership Agreement with the EU in June 2016. It's important to, you know, to keep checking what have been the pros, what have been the negatives in terms of South Africa signing the Economic Partnership Agreement. You see that there are other regions which are hesitant still in signing. Why are those regions not necessarily signing? What are the issues around the EU's engagement with the African continent? But also with our strategic partnership with the EU. And we know that towards the end of the year, there's an EU-Africa summit towards the end of the year. So these are obviously important topics. We need to assess, you know, the extent to which we've gained market access for our products into the EU, but also what have been the costs. Because obviously it's a trade negotiation, so there's wins and there's losses, and in negotiating, I guess you have to be prepared to take both in order to get the deal done. You know, trends in the United States, for instance, these have been significant in shaping and will continue to be significant in shaping North-South relations. In the U.S., there's no real focus at the moment on Africa. there's an interesting graph which I'll try to dig up and send to the committee, which basically analyzes all public statements that Trump has made, and it's a world map essentially. So I try to assess which countries he mentions more in it, and there's virtually no mention of Africa. Now this could be, you know, this doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. The U.S. is preoccupied, right? It's preoccupied with domestic issues. We have an emerging multipolar world order that is taking place, and it's not always necessarily a bad thing. You know, that that they're not necessarily focused on the continent. I mean, obviously there's AGOA, and AGOA has been renewed. There's no sign at the moment, you know, that AGOA, you know, that anything will change in that. So, you know, it's a case of yes, it's an unprecedented presidency in the United States, but I think from a strategic point of view, there's no real need to go and necessarily provoke or get the attention of the superpower which is preoccupied with its own internal problems. I mean, we see they have internal problems, but they also have issues at the moment with their allies. There's uncertainty in the relationship between the United States and its own allies, and they are not sure to what extent they can trust the United States. You know, so these are dynamics which will obviously also shape our international relations, probably force the Europeans to be more self-assertive, to pay more attention you know, to their own collective role, rather than taking it for granted that the United States will always provide a security umbrella for them. You know, so that will probably force the Europeans to rethink some of their partnerships with the United States. I mean, an area here, for instance, is the United States' posture on climate change. South Africa did a lot of hard work with a lot of other emerging economies and many developing countries, you know, putting, and in fact, if the Paris Agreement on climate change, the seeds of that agreement were actually here in Durban, and a lot of hard work has gone into, you know, negotiating the Paris Treaty. It's not perfect. There is no perfect treaty, but, you know, the Trump administration's posture would essentially undo all of that hard work. And I'm glad one of the first things that happened after Macron won the election in France was that his foreign minister essentially said, you know, the Paris Treaty is non-negotiable, you know, and that's obviously important, because the world has to make it clear, obviously, to the United States that this is an important, you know, that climate change is a real thing to a lot of countries on the continent. They have not contributed to it, but they are feeling the effects of climate change, and for them it's not, you know, just an academic thing, and a lot of hard work has obviously gone into putting that agreement together. Move to the area of maritime security and the ocean economy. This is obviously an area that South Africa has identified as a strategic area for the foreseeable future, and that's good. We're a country that is so well strategically located, you know, that irrespective of who governs this country will remain strategic in global trade, in geopolitics. We have the Atlantic, you know, the Indian Ocean, just there. So it's obviously it's always resources are always scarce, but it's important to develop this maritime security, but also the ocean economy, because you see that in many countries across the continent who cannot exercise sovereignty over their waters, there's overfishing that takes place. There's boats coming from Europe overfishing in their waters with any good intentions. If you cannot defend your military waters, you're purely relying on the goodwill of others. And in global politics, we've seen that, you know, that's not a viable strategy, to just rely on the goodwill of others. So it's important to ensure that you have the capacity to actually monitor your exclusive zone in the oceans. But then in doing that and exercising sovereignty over it, then you're able to develop it. Now, South Africa is obviously chairing the Indian Ocean Rim Association in 2017 to 2019, and that's very significant because it ties in quite nicely with South Africa's own prioritization of maritime security and the blue economy. Basically, I mean, IORA is linking Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Australasia via the Indian Ocean, and the Indian Ocean is a strategic ocean, and it will remain so in the foreseeable future, especially if you think of the rise of emerging powers, you think of the rise of Asia, for instance. The Indian Ocean will definitely remain important. So South Africa must have a say in how these how, you know, organizations such as IORA, how they function, what the strategic focus is, and so forth. So that's, you know, that's also something for the committee, which I think is very, very important in ensuring that, while we know that South Africa has recognized the ocean economy as strategic, but, you know, it's important, obviously, that the committee constantly keeps tabs on the type of work that is going into this. We also need to look at, for instance, the 2050 Africa's Integrated Maritime Strategy. We need to have a look at that, because here, what we, you know, ideally what you would be looking at in future is having earlier I mentioned, you know, not just national sovereignty, but sovereignty over the maritime perimeter of the continent. I think that's quite a, as a vision at least, that should be quite important. Let me move then to participatory foreign policy making. Obviously, the role of SACWIR, South African Council on International Relations, is very important. It was launched in June 2015, and it's important that the committee, you know, keeps checking in terms of the work that they are doing. Have they added value to the work of the department? And there's quite, you know, reputable professors and people from labor, business, who are part of that committee. So it's important to, you know, to keep checking, because it's quite, actually, if you look at traditional foreign policy making, it's quite an innovative idea in integrating civil society into foreign policy making. But obviously, like any new institution, it's about how effective or how it actually functions, you know, and therefore it's important that we keep, you know, we keep track, but also that we keep track not just in terms of the advisory role that SACWIR has with the ministry, but also in the outreach that SACWIR does, because there's a huge potential for it to take foreign policy to the people, because we know, as I started in the beginning, the whole world is watching South Africa. It's important that our citizens also understand what's happening in foreign policy, that they have an interest in foreign policy, and that not as a matter of even of studying, you know, a doctor can have an interest in foreign policy, a natural scientist can have an interest in foreign policy, not just as a matter of creating IR analysts in that sense, but that there's a broader discussion in the country about foreign policy. It becomes, I mean, even as a matter of interest for the state, you know, it's quite important that as South Africa has this huge global presence, that people understand what this presence is for, that people understand why South Africa has to engage within the continent, and what would be the perils if South Africa were not to engage, for instance. So the public diplomacy strategy is absolutely critical. And then last three is development diplomacy. So development diplomacy, yes, we know that South Africa is a significant a source also of development cooperation. And you know, we're not fond of words such as donor and such that, or donor recipient, but you know, we stray more into terms such as development partnerships, and that's, you know, there's a recent study which was done on South Africa which was trying to account South Africa's role in the DRC as a development partner. And one of the interesting things in that study is that it actually showed that, you know, globally, that South Africa was a very significant player in terms of its development partnership role in the DRC, even compared with EU donors and so forth. Now, obviously, that goes also into how you define development cooperation and so forth. So it will obviously be important moving ahead with the South African Development Partnership Agency in mind, that we understand what the South African definition of development cooperation, you know, is, because that also assists scholars when they're doing their research. Right now in the scholarship, you know, you have different figures coming out. You have some saying South Africa is a huge donor, some saying it's not a huge donor, and so forth. But that goes because there is no consensus on the actual definition of development cooperation. I mean, China has a white paper on foreign aid where they, you know, defined it so where it was quite clear that certain portions of their development finance do not qualify as development assistance, such as credit loans and things like that. So these are obviously questions which South Africa will have to, you know, to grapple with in terms of quantifying the level of foreign aid that we are providing within the continent, but also outside of the continent. And obviously, you know, from the reports, we see that SADPA is not too far away from actually being operationalized. Now, outside of DIRCO, I mean, obviously, the development scholars and all of that have become, you know, impatient, and they ask, where is SADPA, where is SADPA, where is SADPA? But I think, obviously, you know, if you're on the outside, you don't understand some of the internal matters, you know, that are and some of the complexities of forming such an agency. Many countries have grappled with it, whether it's your Mexico's, whether it's, you know, Brazil, China, India. they're all grappling with this idea of forming a development agency. So it will be interesting to keep monitoring that as a committee, and because obviously South Africa is a significant player in the area of development cooperation, not only in the amounts that we provide, but also in the ideas that go into development, because the development sector is becoming more diversified, and we understand that the OECD doesn't hold a monopoly of thought on issues of development anymore. So as this area becomes more diversified, what's important to check is not just, you know, quantifying how much South Africa is providing, but what kind of ideas is South Africa injecting into this area of development cooperation that distinguishes us from other countries. And then the last two points is just, you know, issues that we need to keep or constantly track of is issues of coordination of foreign engagements among different spheres of government. We see obviously there's a growth of subnational actors engaged in foreign affairs and you know, obviously sometimes that can create contradictions or duplication of work and so forth. So, you know, in a democracy, it's understandable that you may have some of these things, but it's important, you know, obviously the work that DIRCO does as being the lead in our foreign engagements, to see how far we are able to implement the document titled Measures on Guidelines for the Enhanced Coordination of South Africa's International Engagements. That's going to be quite important. And then just the last point on, you know, administration issues, you know, DIRCO plays an important role in terms of training, not just our diplomats, but also training foreign diplomats. So that role is quite important, and we have to also keep, you know, track of that, you know, so and also obviously just things such as moving away from qualified audits and just monitoring those types. I mean, these are just administrative things that obviously the committee will continue to monitor. And then I just ended just with a list maybe of our top 10 trading partners. So South Africa's trade with countries in the world, you know, we have China, Germany, the United States, Botswana, Namibia, Japan, the United Kingdom, India, and Belgium. Then you have your Mozambiques, and this is in the order. And then you have your Mozambiques, your Zambia, Zimbabwe, and it moves forward. I mean, I'll make obviously these tables available. These are tables from the Department of Trade and Industry. So I'll obviously make these available to the committee. So exports to Africa, our biggest destination countries for our exports, it's Botswana, Namibia, Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Lesotho, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, and Kenya, in that order. And the list goes on. And in terms of imports from Africa, Nigeria is at number one, Angola, and then Swaziland, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, Lesotho, you know. So obviously this is the order, but it's obviously for the committee will become important to see what are we trading with them, you know, are we able to export beneficiated goods and so forth. So just to check the quality of our trade with our largest trading partners. I think I just ended there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mtembu, for a very insightful analysis and presentation of our foreign policy and the areas that you have looked into. It is indeed very, very helpful to the committee, and it does alert the department. It does alert the department about the areas to which it must pay due and particular attention, not just the department but the country. And indeed, the people of South Africa, I wish we had a lot of people generally, as you correctly indicated, who must know why we are there and what do we get and what can they contribute as ordinary South Africans to the department and to the country, so that we take advantage of our presence in various institutions of the world. Thank you very much. Now, we had thought that after your presentation, we will then take a briefing from the department, and then we can have an engagement with both presentations after lunch, depending on when the department would have finished. But the disadvantage with that would be that there may not be a focused engagement. Unless we feel that there's nothing to engage or no questions to ask from Dr. Mtembu, because to the department, indeed, there are issues we're going to raise that will inform and guide our debate. So we must be clear about what about that, what about that. But it could be that colleagues do want to make one or two comments on the presentation that has been made. Perhaps let me make that determination. So that must just focus on the department. Well, since Umseven. So let's hear the colleagues whether they have something to say. Mukhalapa?
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me first congratulate the DG on his appointment, and also thank the Deputy Minister for gracing our committee meeting. Thank you very much, Dr. Mtembu, on your presentation. I think my speech is almost half done here, so I'm quite ready for the 25th. Chair, let me just make these three inputs from what Dr. Mtembu has presented to us. The first one is the issue of the readmission of Morocco into the EU. I think it goes without saying that it's water under the bridge at this point in time. And quite correctly, you're saying that they have engaged on a vigorous economic diplomacy to try and get the 39 votes. My view and what I would want to hear from you is that, don't you see, and what must the EU do to ensure that the Sahrawi question is being addressed by Morocco, seeing that Morocco has now been readmitted into the EU? So I just want your thoughts in terms of what needs to be done. Don't you see this as an opportunity that the EU can finally bring closure to the issue of the Sahrawi? Because of the readmission of Morocco without conditions into the EU has always been, and it is, a source of concern. But it is what it is at this point in time. Secondly, on the issue of development diplomacy, I agree with you in terms of ensuring that we don't quantify in terms of how much has been dispersed, but in terms of the impact thereof. Because if you look at the DRC, we are always accused that we are conflicted when it comes to the DRC. We are a major player there. We are contributing quite significantly, but to what end that we end up being conflicted in addressing the conflict there in the DRC. So it is a source of concern that, yes, we are dispersing this development diplomacy, but to what end do we ensure that there is conflict resolution in where we are investing? And linked to that is to say that we go, we assist, and then what is the end game? What happens thereafter? I think on the issue of the training of diplomats, and I think the deputy minister would recall that the last time she was with us, we raised the issue of the quality of the cadets that we filled into this diplomatic missions. And then, yes, we hope that the Foreign Service Bill will assist us. That is why we're so passionate about it, that we get to the finality of the bill in order to upgrade the value of our training diplomats. Because of it's quite very embarrassing that we are training even foreign diplomats, but we find that our diplomats sometimes are found wanting. You know, they are of dubious character, and it's quite a source of concern. Lastly, in terms of trade, I think it's quite sad to look at the top 10 trade countries, and you see that the SADC is only three that appear in the top 10. It's Botswana, Namibia, and Mozambique, and the rest is elsewhere. And I think we as we're chairing the SADC, I think one important point that we are making in all the chairmanship that we'll be assuming is not about the status of it, it's about the impact of it. What impact do we do and get out of this? And we've been talking of the free trade and the tripartite free trade area for a long time, and yet when you look at our trade, it's still, we found one thing in terms of firstly regional trade within SADC, and secondly in terms of continental trade in Africa generally. But thank you very much for your analysis. I think the others are just things that the department will engage on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkhalapa, for your comments. Honorable Maila. Yes, I noted your comments, Honorable Kenya. Maila.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. And thanks, Dr. Mtembu, for the presentation. Also to welcome the presentation by the Deputy Minister. No, Chair, mine was on the readmission of Morocco, following on what Honorable Mkhalapa has said. But I wanted to check what should be the attitude of South Africa towards Morocco. Look, South Africa and Morocco, regarding the Sahrawi Republic, are having opposing views. While South Africa wants the referendum to take place, Morocco seems to be having a different idea. But now, the fact is, it's what's under the bridge. Morocco is part of the EU. Now, what should be the attitude of South Africa towards Morocco? Should the two countries be seen as contenders, or should we create a platform where we can be gradually moving towards having working relations with Morocco in the aim of maybe trying to influence Morocco to see things in the manner that we see it, especially regarding the referendum, which will lead ultimately to the independence of the Sahrawi Republic. The other issue is on the ocean economy. If you look at the Indian Ocean, South Africa is strategically positioned. We have the Indian Ocean, we have the Atlantic Ocean. In the Indian Ocean, we have the Indian Ocean Rim Association. And sometimes back we had the problems of piracy, which is no longer a problem now. But I wanted to check in the Atlantic Ocean. Do we have a similar association of countries if we don't have, are we waiting for a problem to occur before we then strategize and say this is what we should be doing as in trying to protect our waters? Those were just the two that I have, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Maila. Honorable Kenya.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Dr. Pillar. I think we are going to sing the same song, because really we are worried about what is happening to the Sahrawis. And just because I was there, a kind of staying with those people there. It is very pathetic to see people living there for more than 40 years in that desert. Now, I think I share the same sentiment with my colleagues, because we were all frustrated when we heard that Morocco is being re-entered into the African Union without the condition, knowing the situation, what is happening in the Sahrawis. It is worse that that territory, the self-definition of those people in that territory is frustrating. As we know that long ago it was said that Morocco also have got no right to be in that territory, to occupy that territory. So really it's worrying. I was also going to ask this question, what will happen to the Sahrawis, but my colleagues have just asked the question, maybe that will also answer my concern. Secondly, on the issue of silencing of guns by 2020, I don't know, Doctor, maybe you can just, when you give us this presentation, because you said that there are also there are challenges. If you can just also unpack for us the challenges. The reason why I'm asking this, because this is a critical aspect on the African agenda. Maybe if there can be a clear strategies, concrete strategies, that the African agenda, the Africa will be necessary to check concretely the strategies. The reason why I'm saying this, because I'm concerned, because as we know that South Africa was at the center of the destruction of weapons in Syria, but you don't see the tunnel, because even now there are still problems in Syria. If we say that we are silencing the guns, what may be the strategies? Maybe if you can just think the strategies which you know that they are there to curb those challenges, so that that doesn't react okay in 2021 as we see what happened after Syria's destruction of weapons. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kenya. Honorable Khatebe, followed by Mpumlwana.
Thank you, Chairperson. The question I'll just ask one question here. Is the issue of the extraordinary African Chambers, the court which was established by the African Union in trying the former president of Chad, and then that court made serious determinations, and then it convicted that former president to a life sentence for reasons of impunity. And then what I want to know from Dr. Mtemu, how will that such a court, because what happened is that the crime which was committed in Chad was, the person who committed the crime in Chad was charged by using the laws of Senegal, which is the other country. When you know that in our ordinary jurisprudence, we say that a person can only be tried in a court where he has committed a crime. But here it was extraordinary, because it was not even an African Court of Justice type of system, that the laws of another country was used to try that. How do you see it going forward? Because we have got a problem of the capacity of the African Court of Human and People's Rights that does not have the capacity to deal with this thing. So in dealing with this thing, can such a thing, is it a good thing that in moving forward, let's say using countries like South Africa, which have got a strong jurisprudence in dealing with such issues? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khadebe. Honorable Mpumlwana.
Thank you. I want to agree with most of my colleagues, Dokotela. I am Fuitu. We are shy. Thank you very much.
Follow, please.
I just wanted to find out if the amount of influence on the French of France in Africa, particularly in the French-speaking African countries, in relation to the and particularly regarding the Moroccan admission to the country, to the OAU. How strong is it? I also want directly to find out what effect, if any, would be if we suggest sanctions against Morocco because of the occupation of Western Sahara. You also mentioned about Morocco wanting to be a member of the ECOWAS, if I heard you correctly. I also want to know the establishment of the BRICS Bank. Is it a threat to IMF and World Bank? If so, how? Or is it seem like that as one may call a war against the dollar policy? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mpumlwana. Are there any further takers? Well, let me then come in and once again, thank you very much, Dr. Mtembo, for a very good presentation. I'm not sure whether my comments are questions or I'm a comment, but let me just say what I want to say. And it was whether it would be important to analyze the presidency of Trump. Whether in terms of what it does now is a return to the old splendid isolation doctrine or it is imposed upon him by the domestic challenges that were besetting the USA currently in terms of its economy weakening and the rise of China on the other hand, and the challenge that is posed by the Russian Federation, as well as the, I don't like the word, but I'll use it, influx of people into the USA who, in his view, or those who voted for him, whether it is threatening American jobs and all of these other things. So it could be that it is imposed on him because he has got to attend to that which makes the Americans feel uneasy, that any other president would have been compelled to be seen to be attending to the domestic things. But now the challenge is whether the USA one will jettison its influence or its contribution in the whole European zone. In terms of economic contribution, because it does need those countries with which it works in NATO. And the extent to which it will choose and pick in the African continent, or whether it will completely leave Africa alone and what Africa will do with that, I think you've already indicated that. But of course, we may also over a period of time check the extent to which the USA will feel about this kind of, in quotes, rejection of this isolationism that Trump seemed to have championing by the general elections in Netherlands. They did not vote for a party that was going to withdraw from the European Union, and the same thing has happened on Sunday in France. So it could be that it's good for Germany as a regional power, as a regional economic power. It's also good for the European Union. But again, it may have implications for the UK, which then becomes the only one that will live there. We may have to look at that over some time. And also what is interesting is what the policy positions of the USA would be regarding China, regarding the Ukraine, Syria, what they've been doing around the Chinese sea there, its policy on North Korea, etc., etc. So there's a lot of toing and froing by the president there as to what exactly what is he going to be up to. But it is clear that when it comes to wanting to be countries of influence, the president of Russia, Putin, and the president of China, and now the young president of North Korea, want to be felt at all levels, at military level and at diplomatic level. They feel that this cannot be left to the Western countries. So those are actually very important developments. But the last one is in the domestic front. I think the committee needs to be advised how it can work with SACOIA as well as with the department. I don't know who are the other stakeholders, about profiling the good work that the department is doing, but the good work also that South Africa is doing, but the weaknesses of less participation, or who must participate at the level of your colleges, your universities, and other international activists, just knowing what the country is about. The other time I had gone to Zimbabwe, and my colleagues here told me that there were young Chinese scholars or Chinese people who came here. They were impressed. They were impressed with young people of that country who understood the world like the palm of their hands. That's what you told me. So we don't have that amount of cadre in the country. You know, from UCT, from VETS, from everywhere else, from whoever, just young people who know what we're about. So that ultimately when they become MPs and councillors and presidents and whatever they will be, but they know what we must extract for South Africa in the world. Because the criticism now that we get in South Africa is that we are all over the show, but we are not showing enough gains that we get out of trade, out of our involvement in the continent and in the world. And in other words, it is necessary to be selfish as a country. Maybe the word doesn't. I'm using a wrong concept, but that you must say, I'm involved here, but this is what we are getting. For instance, in the African continent, we must be involved in the peacekeeping missions with the others, because there will be no development without peace. But there must be a lot of trade coming our way, making sure that the trade, intra-African trade, is growing from 12%, or if it's still at 12% higher. But we get a lot out of that. Now, the industrial base of the African continent and the manufacturing capacity is still very low. So those are some of the challenges that must be looked at by the people who are dealing with the African Agenda 2063. Otherwise, we'll arrive there with very little achieved, and will also arrive in 2020 with very little achieved, because this matter about absence of peace in some pockets in the continent is occasionally, or externally, I wanted to say externally inflicted. It's not always the players within certain countries. There are other countries outside the continent that actually thrive out of these things that are happening in each of our countries at the level of the political parties, because it is in their interest. So we may arrive by 2020 and find that we are still settled with a very unpeaceful DRC, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah,
but you can respond to some of this, but and of course some colleagues have asked specific questions. Others who want to come in, Raput, you are fine. Okay, Barahman, you are fine. Over to you. Oh yes, when I was talking about USA in relation to China, Russian Federation, North Korea,
there's
water leaking there, electricity,
there's
no
such
electricity. Oh, thank you very much. I was saying, Dr. Mtembo, whether a Trump administration in my implications for the progress, the pace of progress in resolving the Middle East imbroglio, Palestine, Israel, things like that. Yeah, I just left that out. Over to you.
10 minutes. Yes. Let me first start with the readmission of Morocco. I mean, now that Morocco has been, it has been readmitted, I mean, this is hindsight. Of course, one might have, wanted a situation probably when you say, yes, we'll readmit you, but let's obviously solve this, let's solve the elephant in the room, you know. I mean, that would have been the ideal. But now that has not happened. And what that means is that essentially with Western Sahara, I mean, you really don't have too many options. The option is, yes, full sovereignty. That's one. Another option is recognition of where it's an autonomous area, but actually doesn't achieve full sovereignty, where maybe it's under UN under a UN mandate, or it's under an AU mandate, for instance. You know, the only other options that you can really see outside of full sovereignty, but where it also doesn't remain, fully within within Morocco, is if you handed over authority to an African Union or to a United Nations. I mean, there's precedent historically of countries which have done that and have actually seen that as a transition towards full sovereignty. But the issue obviously is the referendum. I mean, Morocco doesn't want the referendum, but I think there are still merits to push for a referendum, but under the United Nations mandate or under the African Union mandate. And if you can't get a referendum, then it would have to still be an authority where it has full control of its domestic
affairs. So that, you know, obviously shouldn't be a negotiable thing. It should have full, you know, authority over its domestic affairs. Where it will become tricky with the role of Morocco is authority over its international relations. And that's where I think we probably have to start, you know, thinking outside of the box and thinking, you know, what role does the could the AU play there in terms of actually being entrusted as an authority over Morocco, or what role, for instance, with the Arab Maghreb Union, but a functional Maghreb Arab Union. You know, what role would a functional Arab Maghreb Union have, you know, to play? There's a scholar who just wrote a paper on this very issue, where he was actually arguing that you know, if you can't get full sovereignty, you know, then the next thing is to try and integrate Western Sahara not into Morocco, but to integrate it into the region, and that it into the region as a, I mean, it's an autonomous an autonomous area, but it doesn't take on full sovereignty as in the sense of a nation state, but it takes on a kind of a regional sovereignty. So in that way, you're making sure that Morocco can exercise influence over it, but you're making also sure that the African Union has some kind of control in what happens, you know, in Western Sahara. But really, it's difficult, because an opportunity, I think, has been lost in terms of bargaining properly with Morocco, and saying, yes, we actually want you to be readmitted, but let's sort this issue out, you know, and arrive at a political solution. So I certainly think, I mean, pressure should still be maintained, because, I mean, obviously the ideal situation for Morocco is for the status quo, you know, and where it's de facto under Moroccan control. But that poses a danger, because what happens if you have a resurgence of an armed struggle, you know, if you don't give some kind of a real meaningful autonomy in Western Sahara, you know, you're really going to create a situation where the Arab Maghreb Union will continue to be dysfunctional, but also where you have a situation where you might still have a return of an armed struggle. So the issue hasn't been resolved. I mean, Morocco, yes, is in the AU, but the issue has not yet, you know, been resolved. And I still think that there is still a way, you know, I mean, South Africa should still play a role, shouldn't just, you know, say, okay, well, we just accept this is how things are. But obviously there needs to be a change in strategy, because the strategy we were using was when Morocco was not yet in the African Union. And now we need a new strategy, which, you know, is something that's going to have to come, you know, through the department, consulting, you know, with experts, and so forth, you know, in terms of what are other viable ways to keep the pressure on Morocco, but to bring a bigger role for the African Union or the United Nations in terms of ensuring the status of Western Sahara. It has to be a regional approach. If it's not the UN, it has to be the African Union, which is able to exercise authority in a meaningful way over Western Sahara. And I think, you know, in terms of development diplomacy, you know, the question, you know, to what end? I mean, we are often afraid, you know, to say that
you know, I mean, often what fails in countries which have gone through conflict is if those countries are not able to see any meaningful progress in their social, you know, in their society, in their economy, those societies revert back to conflict. But we've often tended to be a bit ambivalent about economic interests, you know, in countries that are moving out of conflict. And I think we, you know, this probably, that ambivalence creates some of those issues, you know, in the DRC where you have people saying, hey, but we've poured this much amount of money in there, what are we actually getting out of the DRC? Or what are we getting out of any other country, you know, that we're engaging in? So I think economic diplomacy is an essential part of post-conflict reconstruction and development. I mean, it really is an essential part. But I think where we have to distinguish ourselves is in making sure that, and in business, it's easier said than done, you know, in making sure that, you know, you don't just have foreign companies running into a country and carving it out because taking advantage of its insecurity. But and we do this in some parts of our development cooperation where we train the officials, we help, you know, build institutions, we help drafting legislation and so forth. I think what we need to think of is in terms of a whole package, you know. I mean, we not just the peacekeeping element, because you know what's going to happen. Obviously, if we're not thinking in those terms, is that we will engage and be involved as peacekeepers, but that a France or a China or an India or you know or a US. Is then able to reap the dividends of that peace that is actually created. So I think, you know, I mean, China speaks of win-win. And when you say win-win, there are no contradictions between a country pursuing what it sees as its economic interest, but also making sure that the country where it's pursuing its interests also meets its interests, that infrastructure is developed, that institutions are built, and that there's capacity development and so forth. I think what we need to understand is probably the narrative, is to have maybe a better mastery of the narrative. Because the moment you say economic interest, it's almost like it's a bogeyman. I mean, but, you know, which country does not have economic interest? You know, and with our context, it becomes obviously complicated because of our history as a state, not our history as those who currently run the country, but as the state, the South African state, which was involved with a lot of destruction in the region. And also, I mean, we have to be also frank. I mean, we have to also think about the profile of businesses that are able to take opportunities on the continent. If African countries mostly see white South Africans or white business people, they already are skeptical of, you know, of the, and they are always, I mean you see this in some of the countries where they say, ah, but you know, South Africa, it's only, you know, the big businesses that are able to go there. But if we also are able to change the profile of the type of businesses, and you have, you know, get small and medium enterprises, get young entrepreneurs to also explore opportunities outside of South Africa, you know, I think that will also make, you know, a difference. I mean, I think we have to be honest in a sense that makes a difference. I mean, if countries on the continent see that, well, you have these big corporations in South Africa which, you know, benefited under apartheid, and now they are benefiting, you know, in the democratic dispensation. Then what are we doing to say, I mean, of course you cannot limit business people from going there. But we probably also need to, you know, think about the type of business delegations that we're sending, but also just the type of business. Often when we think of business, we think of big businesses going into countries, constructing huge roads and all of that. But on the continent, there's a lot of small traders. There's a lot of small and medium enterprises, both official and unofficial, that takes place across the continent. And if we can probably find ways of connecting, you know, those business people, you know, that also changes the profile of the South African business. You know, not you thinking you're big checkers or, you know, and others. I mean, every country anyway has this problem. China has that problem where it goes out and it engages in African countries, and it has a certain vision. But then Chinese private companies, not just the state-led enterprises, they go there and they are involved in some nefarious business and all of that, and it creates a bad perception. You know, these guys are selfish, they're here to exploit us, and so forth. With South Africa, it makes it even easier, you know, to say, ah, but these guys were exploiting us anyway in the past. And look, it's still the same guys who were, you know, who were exploiting us. Yes, it's a different government, but the economy still remains. And, you know, it's a narrative, you know. Even if on the ground you're trying to change it. But I think we must also be aware, to be honest, that in pursuing our interests, it also becomes very easy to use South Africa's strengths against us. I mean, it's easy to call South Africa a big brother and therefore prevent it from pursuing, you know, certain interests. And because of our style of diplomacy, and we approach things in a multilateral way, we want to achieve consensus and so forth. It makes it, you know, much easier, I think, for other countries to just say, hey, you guys are the big brothers, you know, and then we step back, you know. But there has to be a point at somewhere where our national interests are let's say better defined, and countries understand that, you know, these are the national interests of South Africa. It is to pursue the African agenda, but in pursuing it, this is the vision that we have, you know, for the African agenda, and not be afraid, I think, of pursuing it. But I think that's just, you know, in our diplomatic culture, which is understandable because of the historical context. I can't, you know, go through all of the questions, but let's see. I mean, ocean economy, we do have a similar one, but it's not exactly like IORA. You have the zone of peace and cooperation of the South Atlantic, where Brazil plays an important role over there. So you do have something similar, but it's not functioning as well. So I think in part of our strategy, these are things we need to obviously look at to make sure that the organizations we're involved in, both at the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean, are actually organizations that are, you know, functioning. But there is something that is similar. And then I'm probably not the best to answer the question of the extraordinary African chambers, but, you know, but just to say that I think it raises obviously certain challenges in terms of
I mean, we know what happened with the ICC. We have a good grasp of why things happened, you know, in that direction. But it creates question marks as to where does, you know, how does the African continent deal with, you know, people who may have been found to have, you know, committed crimes against humanity and so forth. You know, this is a, it's a legitimate question for, especially for a country like South Africa, where, which comes from a, its own history, or where apartheid was declared a crime, you know, against humanity. So it's a question that South Africa does have to grapple with. But obviously, we've seen, yes, there might be limitations in the ICC. South Africa has taken a stance on the ICC. But it doesn't remove the fact that South Africa still has to, you know, think of how do we deal with that from a foreign policy perspective, where a fellow country on our continent, where leaders do things that, you know, that we are not really happy with. You know, obviously we've used things like quiet diplomacy in the past, but this is a question that's unresolved yet. It has tensions because, yes, on the one side we advocate issues of sovereignty, South-South cooperation, and we don't want to infringe into the sovereignty of other states. But I think we do have to find answers in terms of how we deal and with countries which do things, frankly, which do not take our African agenda forward. You know, so that's obviously something, an open question mark in terms of how we deal with that. Is BRICS a threat? I don't think the BRICS bank is a threat, and I don't think it necessarily sees itself as a threat. But the politics of it might be a threat, because, you know, if you control 70% of a pie, and then suddenly you've got emerging powers rising, and then suddenly you're controlling 50% of the pie, you know, you might see it as a threat, whereas the other guys are saying, hey, we're just working on our own self-reliance, we're trying to do things our own way, you know. So if you see it in a zero-sum game, then it becomes a threat. But I don't think it's necessarily a threat. I mean, you look at the loans that it's been given. I mean, who could question the type of loans that the BRICS Development Bank has given in the area of renewable energies? Who could question the infrastructure funding that China has been providing on the African continent, where other countries have actually failed to provide funding for that? I mean, if you see that as a threat, then what is it about your country's national interest that finds it okay for infrastructure to not be built on the African continent, and that you don't put resources into that? You know, so the development space is opening up, and because it's opening up, it reflects what's happening in terms of moving away from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. US is going to remain powerful. That's the reality. The US's power is not going to just go away, but their relative power, they will not in future be able to do things unilaterally as they were doing now, and it is going to frustrate them, and they will see it as a threat, and they will see other countries as moving against the liberal American order and all of that. But we just have to understand that has to do with interest. You know, it's not that you go out developing your country because you want the other country to not develop. You develop your country, you grow your trade ties. But, you know, for instance, the EU still remains a very significant trade partner for South Africa. And often you find people saying South Africa has ditched the EU and is supporting its BRICS partners. Now, that's an oversimplification of issues. South Africa is diversifying its trade partners. South Africa has to trade more with its own continent. If South Africa trades more with its continent, is going to trade less with some other countries. It's not because it has a position against those other countries, but it must trade more with the African continent. We know that in Europe, over 60% of the trade is inside of Europe. We know that in Asia, 40%. We know that, to be a successful region, you have to integrate more with each other. And in doing that, those countries have to find new markets. But it's not because you are opposed necessarily to them, but it is an imperative to trade more within your own region and to build the necessary infrastructure so that people can move around more freely, so that goods can move from a landlocked country and get into a container ship and make their way into the market much faster. These are things Africa has to do in order to develop. It has to do them. It's not because it dislikes, other countries, but the opposite. In fact, if you just continued with the same thing and expected, different results, I mean, what does that say about you? I know there's a number of questions I've left out, but the last one, maybe let me pick up, is on Trump and the Trump presidency. I think if you look at U.S. foreign policy, there's been a trend throughout the different administrations, even going back to the Bush administration. When George Bush came in, he spoke about nation building at home as opposed to nation building abroad. Now, his administration was taken over by the Hawks. And they went and started wars and that. So he wasn't able to actually implement what he came in saying he would implement. So, and then Obama came in, and Obama also spoke about nation building at home rather than abroad, and said, don't do stupid things, that the U.S. mustn't do stupid things abroad. So there's been an undercurrent in American society, I think, where Americans do want their administration to focus more on their own issues. If you look at the stats in the U.S. on poverty and all of that, it's amazing. I mean, for the U.S. it's a superpower, it's a military superpower, but its infrastructure is crumbling. Its healthcare system, it's nothing to for any developing country to try to replicate. You have really big socio-economic problems within the U.S. There may be a superpower militarily, but when we go to socio-economic indicators, they are doing not so well compared to their fellow European counterparts. In healthcare, in life expectancy, and all those different socioeconomic indicators. So there is this undercurrent, and U.S. politicians have ignored certain sections of their own society, in looking for dragons to slay abroad. They have neglected certain elements of their own society, which fed into this populism that Trump was able to exploit. And these people are obviously they have real issues. I mean, there's workers, white workers in the U.S. I mean, there are certain figures even show that even while they are better off still than black and Hispanic workers, but relative to them, their situation is actually going down. In the 70s and 80s, you could leave as a white, worker in the U.S. without a high school a certificate, and you would still be guaranteed to get a job in certain factories and all of that. But there's a whole generation of those people who are frustrated, frankly, with what's happening inside the U.S. and they don't want the U.S. running abroad and finding problems. So that's fed into the Trump presidency, and obviously Trump will also have a difficult time staying away from unilateral interventions and so forth. He criticized the Iraq war, but unilaterally he sent bombers into Syria, because I think within the U.S. establishment you do have this culture where a president must be able to exert power, and it's obviously something that's false. I mean, it doesn't hold, and the more the U.S. does that, the more they actually accelerate their relative decline. Because there's only a certain amount of that they can actually sustain these unilateral foreign interventions. And we are seeing, to a lot of problems, they need other partners to solve. They can't just go into the Middle East and solve an issue unilaterally. They need partners in those regions to work with. They can't solve a North Korea. No matter what Trump says in saying that he's just going to, if China doesn't cooperate, he's just going to go in there. And no, he's not. He's not going to do that. And that shows that globally, the U.S. is also trying to grapple with this changing world order. It's not too sure yet, how to navigate these new waters, but it is trying and it is grappling, with it. And it will lead, I think, as I said earlier, the Europeans to focus more on their own security and understand that they cannot just rely on the U.S. Protection. So I think I just leave it there. I mean, you'll have to forgive me for other questions that I wasn't able to answer.
Thank you very much. Except for the word you have used when you said that Morocco grants autonomy to Western Sahara. I had the Western Sahara ambassador taking issue with what Morocco calls autonomy, because he felt that it's like the Bantustanization of so they are married to self-determination,
yeah.
Complete self-determination. They suspect that when they say, ah, well, you can live within the Moroccan territory, but you can be autonomous,
mm-hmm.
And that's why they are running away from the referendum. But it's a discussion for another day. But that's what you were saying at the public lecture on Western Sahara. DM, just before you leave, do you have any comments?
Yes, thanks very much, Chair. Just maybe on Morocco, I think Dr. Mtembu is spot on most of these issues. With Morocco, I just want to say, this is an area we deliberated on, trying very hard as South Africa and those that support the struggle of Sahrawi people to block Morocco from, coming back again. But unfortunately, there are no conditional acceptance. You see, the AU doesn't have that. If they apply, you follow certain steps, and they are accepted. Now, I think also, Dr. Mtembu was correct. I don't think it's all doom and gloom. Having both Sahrawi and Morocco there, now that there's no other alternative, but what we need to try is to make sure that struggle doesn't end because Morocco is there, but also AU is very strict about the rules of engagement of AU members, because whilst there's no conditional acceptance of a member, the reason why Morocco left AU when it was still that time was because they would not be allowed to do certain things around Sahrawi. So I think if we can, hopefully, as they work together, there would be a sort of a move towards beginning to talk, beginning to dialogue about what is happening. Because I'm sure, I mean, Morocco understand that Sahrawi is not going to give up and their rightful claim. And so assisted by other countries, hopefully they would start talking and sort of this whole issue would be much easier than when, you know, they are real enemies that can't even talk or have a platform like AU to discuss issues. That's one. I mean, the economic diplomacy, I just wanted to comment, you know, Dr. Mthembu is correct. We, in fact, we've seen, and we've been talking about this, we've seen a lot of time being spent in countries because the approach here too is also not just about economic diplomacy. It's also about Ubuntu. Where there's a problem, we volunteer ourselves to try and assist in solving that problem. We are more occupied by peace and stability of an area, because when there's war and conflict, you can't do anything. You can't be starting with economic diplomacy when there's trouble in a particular area. And this creates a situation at times where, as you are saying, we are seen as people who don't necessarily press to, you know, benefit economically from that relationship. I mean, we have incidents where we were all active in places like South Sudan. And then, you know, whilst we're active about the stability and unity, other countries would jump in, one, two, they've signed deals with South Sudan. Same applies to most of these unilateral sanctions, especially of USA. You know, it was clear to us at some stage that at times they are deliberately made so that by the release of that sanction is done after that country has been able to sign, oh, okay, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. And then it's purely for economic benefit from many, many countries, not even if it's the America, but all the allies would come in and want to build this, want to build the airport, want to build this. And, you know, that would be in line with, you know, when and how are we lifting sanctions after we've signed on the dotted line. And I mean, it's been happening, I think, from ourselves. We really need to strategize about how we mix the two and create, whilst we doing that, we know that we do need investment. So our partners, though our other countries are great with that, I mean, country like Iran was very firm in saying, you know, they are friends who've been with me through a long time, so I'm not going to sign with any other person. Those are my friends. They come first.
Thank you, Chair.
Well, that's good education, at least for me. Deputy Minister, thank you very much. See you in the afternoon if you are able to come back. And Dr. Mthembu, thank you very much. You are free to stay on. Colleagues, what do we do? Have a 5-minute human rights break and then get into the presentation, or latch into the presentation and people can grab tea and other things so that we save time. Which one? The last one. Okay, thank you very much.
Director General, the new Director General, over to you and your team.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I must just start by thanking you for having overseen us during my tenure as the acting DG from last year. It's almost 12 months now. We really would like to save your time. All what we are doing, it is to lift elements from this annual performance plan as tabled and take note of the fact that the staff plan, since it was crafted during this current term, administration, has not materially changed as the strategic objectives are still intact the way they are. We only looked at tweaking some of the performance indicators and targets, as is the case as we do. And really to honestly allude to the fact that due to the planning cycle of government and in view of the fact that you operate in a very dynamic context, so the product started as from June last year and has not taken care of what may have happened thereafter. I do have, because of the elements contained here, which is what we call performance information and financials, which is our budget, the two offices, which is the office of the COO, which embeds planning, and then the office of the CFO, which then brings up financials and integrated as such, will then assist me in taking these two elements. But further than that, we have brought along the head of this ARF Secretariat, a capacity that we have just enhanced as from last year, but which we now have a full complement of. We should really thank the committee for having privileged us with the analysis that has just been done here, and to still remind the Honorable Committee that, by the way, the work of the committee is not in the country. It is elsewhere. It wouldn't be just that when the committee has to do a study too, because what you are overseeing is actually is what we are doing in the mission. From around here, as close as Gaborone, Swaziland, Lesotho, up to Moscow or Canberra and elsewhere. And we still would like to feel that the committee may want to drive in one of its best combis, so that as the committee oversees us and directs us, even in our own foreign policy output, it actually speaks from experience. I think the most traveled portfolio committee, if not the only one, is this one. But suffice also to say, it is one of the committees, having worked in different contexts, that is definitely forced to be multipartisan in its approach, since it carries the whole national agenda. And I believe that with having said that, I will just quickly take through the committee, the situation analysis, the majority part of which was done for us through the analysis we just got now, which we'll take into consideration. Honorable members, within the performance environment, we still are of the view that our foreign policy outlook is based on our commitment to the values and ideals of Pan-Africanism, solidarity with people of the South, and the need to cooperate with all peace-loving people across the globe in pursuit of shared prosperity and just equitable rules-based international order. We sum this up in a maxim when we say a better South Africa in a better continent within a better world order. So this is what the outcome is coined from. And therefore, this same policy is implemented within a very highly dynamic, I must say, whereby one time we were so scared about the conservative populist approach the world was taking, and we have just witnessed the reversals or the balancing thereof, so much that what we feared has been mitigated. However, we still hold on to the plans that we had, and it is often unpredictable and complex, and my COO will always summarize it as a VUCA reality. Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and then ambiguity, which is characterizing the kind of work that this committee is overseeing. And then the other thing is that the changes, of course, in the global order always reveal this uncertainty, as alluded to. But on the other hand, the reality is what is happening around the global economic spectrum, where it is characterized by sharpened decline in commodity prices, which has greatly dissuaded investment and adversely impacted socioeconomic development and improved conditions in our continent, our global south, and to a certain extent, even in developed countries. And then earlier there was a reference to the delays in the finalization of the free trade area negotiations, which we would always say, for as long as those matters that are sticky, which will impact on our economy as the recipient economy in the main, because ours is an economy that has more pull factors than any other. So we're still negotiating and hoping we'll conclude it, especially the rules of origin, you know, the movement of business, etc., which will ultimately have to answer to some of the emerging issues on the economic environment. So those kinds of things are key to us in that they affect how this finalization, starting from the tripartite up to the continental, and we are mindful of the fact that at the end of the day, the ratification will still be done through the very same committee here, which is overseeing us. So on the operational side, which I'm not going to take you long about, in the interest of allowing the key matters to be tabled before the committee, I should emphasize the fact that, and I should still, and I'm really pleading that, we would still wish that the white paper process be finalized. We cannot easily quote a policy document that has not received the blessing from this committee, and so that it encapsulates most of the things we refer to, which informs the mantra of our policy dictates there. But our diplomatic service is actually discharged, as we said, in a dynamic environment within varying foreign legislative jurisdictions. As we will know that on our employment side, you know, we're employing almost over 1,900 foreign or locally placed people, locally recruited personnel, to do support to our diplomatic service. But as we employ them in terms of their local legislation, which in some cases may be in contrast with our values, as we do, and it creates a lot of administrative burden for us. And when we are asked by Treasury to do the employment, what you call compensation of employee ceiling, when you have to implement that kind of a thing, other than what you know we do in a bargaining manner in the country, it will not just be as easy as that. And more over and above varying legislative jurisdictions, we are directly affected by monetary regimes. The CFO will attest to the fact that the currencies in which we operate are more than 30, but of which the key is the dollar and the euro anyway. But having to deal with those things are part of what we have to interact with, unfortunately, as part of our mandate. So we would refer to the fact that as at the time of this annual performance plan, we were recording a number of 124 missions, because at that time we were taking note of the fact that the mission in Tripoli, Libya, suffered from natural attrition when the country disintegrated. So it meant we will also have to close shop. And then our embassy in Uruguay, Montevideo, which we had to close down. However, we are in the process of adding substitutes there. One in the Holy See. Honorable members will notice that the Vatican City played a very important role in mediation efforts. One example is Mozambique, DRC, and almost everywhere, especially in the continent. So strategically, and as we will refine as we move, for our national interest as well as our values, which is an interplay, we will be guided by those in a different, varying manner, but we have to take note of that. And then that was alluded to through the analysis that our footprint is the only lever that has ensured that we are occupying the space we are occupying. And we are still hosting the majority of, missions second to Washington, D.C. This is due to, among others, our infrastructure, so much that some countries are using our base to be accredited to other countries, neighboring countries. You might find a country situated in Pretoria's mission, the mission situated there, but accredited to Egypt. You see, we don't have that privilege because there is no other South Africa elsewhere where you can utilize the existing infrastructure to run your businesses in a much better way. Unfortunately, the reality we cannot run away from. The other important thing that we'd like to just put it as a context is that the implementation of this current annual performance plan will still focus on the matters that have been identified in our strategic, which forms part of our strategic objectives, still strengthening of economic and political relations. The traditional international relations discourse will talk about diplomacy, which is just ordinarily political relations, but the time and space has prescribed that your economic diplomacy becomes a vehicle so that your market penetration is well conducted and through, among other structured bilateral mechanisms at different levels. So we'll utilize, as it was alluded earlier, our SADC chairship to focus our programs, which will expedite our regional integration agenda. Much to do exactly what was observed by the analysis that if you look at the topmost trading countries, SADC has only three, but there are three elements that SADC is looking at currently: industrialization, infrastructure build, and socioeconomic cohesion. So we hope that will be taken care of, but the AU Agenda 2063, which is also very much in alignment with our NDP, and that has much more symbiotic with the SDGs, is still that which we believe will bolster our continental prosperity with reduced reliance on international cooperation partners to ensure they use financial independence. It comes at a big cost, as honorable members will see when the financials are put down. To do just that has a very big impact on us as a country and as a government. So further than that, we're still supporting peace and security efforts in the continent to ensure positive growth. We just gave examples of many hot spots, but we are not leaving out Lesotho. It doesn't mean we forget, but there is of a different nature and extent, but we're still playing a role, and it is funded from us as a department, and therefore the efforts to bring a tranquility there are part of what we are involved in over and above those that are listed there. So we still continue to strengthen our North-South relations, particularly with the UK and the EU, which is well known by now. We can't even elaborate on that. But still working, strengthening working relations with the US after the ascendancy of the President Trump. We take note of what has gone on, the many pronouncements, sometimes contradictory, and at times not even feasible, because the power of Congress there, as like the power of Parliament here, always will steer the ship exactly where it has been anyway. So we take note of that element. That, for example, we are arguing that our business community can have business community to business community relationships that can traverse whatever could be a hint should there be anything that affects us. But as a country, we know very well that that is a federal country, including on climate change. I mean, if you look at the U.S. Architecture, it is more at state level that the pronouncement of or that are in akin to our climate negotiations at state level, we are still safe, we believe, amidst what the president could be saying there. It is just, by the way, just to indicate that these are some of the things that in policy, in implementing foreign policy, you also have to navigate how, when changes come, you can position yourself to still survive with whatever we do in pursuit of your own national interest and values. So with the BRICS chairship, which we'll assume precisely from 1 January 2018, but the summit in China in September will obviously be a handover summit. We still believe that this is a vehicle for a shared common vision to be pursued through economic cooperation. And I must indicate that we do have a temporary office of the Africa Regional Center in Johannesburg, which of the new bank. However, we are still dealing with the host country agreement issues. There will always be some unintended legislative hindrances, such as what do you do with the taxation of locals who will be working in an institution such as that. Those sticky matters just to finalize in order to fully launch the Africa Regional Center of the New Development Bank are underway, and we hope during this financial year we will be able to come over it. It is, by the way, just one of those areas that we felt it is necessary to indicate. Other than this, honorable members, I'll just defer to my colleagues, the chief director planning to take the honorable committee on the performance or aspect of our APP, and then the CFO will then indicate the budgetary elements to it. Thank you very much, honorable chair.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chairperson, DG, Honourable Members. Good morning. As the DG has given us a situational context, also taking cognizance of the report that we had a little bit earlier, then what we've done in terms of our presentation is just to give a sense of the allocated funds that we've received in terms of our financial year. So our budget for the new financial year is $6.5 billion. And what are we going to do with that money? We're going to go and then deliver on our targets that we have structured in our APP. So in terms of our program one, honorable members would have noticed that there is a reduction in terms of the targets that we have stipulated in the APP. The process that we normally go through is when we table our first APP, we submit it to the DPME and we submit it to National Treasury in August. Then it goes back in November again. So DPME has advised that the printed departmental APP should not have too many operational targets. So we will then notice that is why in Program 1, which is our support function, we have less targets. However, it does not mean that we are not tracking and we are not delivering on that work. When we come back a little bit later in the year, honorable members will see that when we table our annual report, there's a whole component that talks about our human resources management. So we have that all that we will account for. So the fact that it's not as a target does not mean that it does not it does not get executed. It gets tracked at a branch level. So if I then can get back to the program, one, our strategic objectives in terms of our strategic plan. Our strategic plan is exactly the same plan that we tabled last year. It is a five-year plan. The five-year plan is to coincide with the MTSF, so it will be then until 2020. So our strategic objectives are the same, so they get carried over into the annual performance plan. And what is it that we would want to achieve? And there goes the computer. What is it that we would like to... I'm going to continue whilst we... No, it's the battery. It's the battery. So if I can continue whilst they try to sort it out for us. On page 10, so if we then look at our targets on page 10, that we will try to reduce our vacancy rate within the national average of 10%. However, when the CFO present the budget, the CFO will then also focus on the ceiling that is being placed on the compensation of employees. So the balancing act that the department has to maintain in terms of trying to reduce your vacancy rate within your national average of 10%. However, National Treasury gives you a limited budget in terms of what you can utilize for compensation of employees. In terms of our ICT, we're looking at least for this year, to start with the implementation of the integration of our financial system, of our ICT systems, both the financial and the human resource system, so that we can improve the way that we account for our financials. Now, here we're looking at that we have a BAS, we have a PERSEL, we have a LOGIS, we have a Mission Cashbook system. So we have various ICT systems in terms of the various structures and processes we report. So we're looking at working towards a fully integrated ICT system. Yes, we acknowledge that we have had a qualified audit, but we are putting all processes in place and administrative processes to work towards an unqualified audit. So we are looking towards that. So then also in terms of our training, our strategic objective, and I take note of the request, the question that we had a little bit earlier on the quality of our training. Now, we have an accredited training program, meaning it's accredited by the PCTA and also then quality assured by the QCTO. So we're looking at 113 training programs, and we're looking at our stakeholder engagement. This is our research that's being done by PROW, and we're targeting 15 for the year, as well as various research papers that we've reported on before that our research unit will do. So if we then look at in terms of our economic classification, so for the targets I've just indicated, and this is a summary of what's in the printed APP, I have then the proposed budget allocation for this year is 1.5 billion. So we just show the alignment there. That is program one, which is our administration program. In terms of program two, which is our international, which is our substance, and this particularly focuses on our bilateral relations that we have with other countries. And once again, we're starting with the premise that our bilateral engagements are the basis for the strengthening political and economic relations. So you first have to have a relationship before you can pursue particular objectives, whether it be your national interest, whether it be a peace and security, whether it be a developmental agenda. You need to have that bilateral relations first. So we are working on that as our premise and our starting point, that that is our platform for engagement to maintain our diplomatic relations. So if we then turn to page 13, so our target then for the year is that we will utilize 30 of our structured bilateral mechanisms and 40 high-level visits. Now, a structured mechanism means that there is an agreement signed between South Africa and the other country that governs the interaction. It determines at what level the engagement takes place, whether it be at a president, deputy president, minister, or a senior official's level, and also how often, and then also what areas of cooperation will be pursued through that engagement. So, when we do the high-level visits and our structured engagement, it is to work towards the 9-point plan, the 5 cross sectoral issues that were identified in SONA this year, looks at our national priorities. So it will be to see what is it that we can do for our health priorities at home. So for example, the PEPFAR program that we have with the USA, for example, what is it that we're going to do with regard to education? So those are the issues that we would pursue in terms of our structured mechanisms. Then when we, so the first part is political in program two, and then the second part is economic diplomacy and pursuing our national interest. And this is exactly where our missions are delivering on the work that they need to do, because they are the coalface. They are the interaction in the country of accreditation. So what we are looking at is they need to identify various stakeholders. They need to engage with their stakeholders. For example, we have finally come to the point, and when we table our annual report, we'll talk about it again, is that we finally opened up the market in China for our agriculture, for our beef exports, for example. So you can't upfront target that you want to open the market, because you have to negotiate with the other country. So, but they will engage with the Chamber of Commerce, they will meet with relevant government ministries. So our target for our missions on page 15, and we are looking at 112 trade and investment seminars. So we're looking at, that is where we will showcase our South African products, whether it be our wine, whether it would be our agricultural, our other agri-processed products that we will be, so instead of just exporting the fruit, we will be looking at exporting fruit juice as well. So that is the agri-processed products that we're talking about. So we are targeting 112 trade and investment seminars across the world. We're looking at engagement with the Chamber of Commerce that we will have. So this is particularly where we've identified there are market access issues. So if there are particular issues that hinders the export of South African products to that country, then our missions will then identify those chambers of commerce they need to speak to, and then they will start working on what is it that can be done. For example, if we want to export meat products to the UAE, it means that all our abattoirs at home must meet strict halal requirements. Therefore, it means that they will have to come and do inspections. So in order for South Africa to know that, it means that our mission will engage with a country, for example, the UAE. They will inform our relevant departments at home so that those processes can be put in place. And that is the kind of work. So we might not necessarily report on the fact that we have increased the trade, but we allow our other government partners as well as our private business to actually then do that. 70 engagement with target and government ministries. This is particularly with regard to our priorities. If we're pursuing science and technology, for example, let's meet with the Department of Science and Technology on that side. Can we look at a skills transfer? Can we look at cooperation and for example, the SKA that we have in the Northern Cape? So that is the engagement that will happen at the mission level as well. Meeting with high-level potential investors, for example, if we look at the engagement that our ambassador is doing in the Ukraine, we have increased our exports of coal to the Ukraine, for example. It means that that ambassador would have worked with those government ministries, the Department of Energy on that side, what is the source of energy and how we can work on that, because that is a particular issue, because previously we know that the Ukraine got the source of power in terms of the gas. So, of course, they have to look at alternatives as well. And this is then the role that the mission will then look around at what's happening in the country and how we can see how we can improve South Africa's economic or contribute to our economic growth. Tourism is a huge issue for us because we know that it's a huge source of revenue. So that we are asking our missions, what we need to do is for people then to identify South Africa as a tourism destination, they need to know about South Africa. So it's the work of the missions then to identify whether they're meeting with tourist operators, whether they would have National Day events, where they would screen play, they would get information from Brand SA, they would get information from STAT, from National Department of Tourism, and then tell those countries about South Africa so that we can improve and increase our tourism numbers. So that is the focus for program two. This is the work that is particularly then done in terms of our bilateral. And this then, of course, means that this is about the payments and the obligations that we have in terms of those 124 missions that we have abroad. And that is why we will note, and now I will just ask the CFO, because I note that on the presentation that was distributed, the total for Program 2 was not allocated, but the revised one does have it. and we will then project that when the CFO talks about Program 2, because that's where the bulk of our budgets is at the moment, to maintain our foreign presence abroad. So then, part of Program 2, apart from our bilateral work, we also focus on our regional integration, which is SADC. And then here what we're looking at is, we know that we have just taken over the chairship of SADC, and there's a particular strategy that we want to pursue in terms of what we want to maintain with regard to SADC. So we've identified our SADC summits, we've identified our Council of Ministers engagement, as well as the SADC structures and processes, to see how can we deliver on the indicated strategy that we have for our chairship, taking note of the conversation a little bit earlier, that it's not necessarily only about being there, but what value and what impact are you making whilst you are there. And the focus particularly for this term is to look at the regional integration, and we know that the regional integration, the RISDP, the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan, has been approved, and we know that SADC is currently working on an implementation plan in terms of identifying regional value change for specific sectors, and DTI is doing specific work around that as well. So that is what we're looking at targeting. And then, of course, one of the issues in terms of us supporting peace and security, one aspect of that would be with regard to the election observer missions. So, of course, we would target that, because we would then become part of the SADC observer missions. In most of the instances, South Africa leads those election observer missions. That is what we're targeting for Program 2 for the new financial year. In terms of Program 3, which is multilateral, so it refers to our global governance, as well as our continental work, as well as South-South and North-South. So that is our international relations, international cooperation, which is our multilateral. So once again, if we go back to what the NDP states, that South Africa must remain an influential player on the global governance arena. Now, how do you remain influential? It means that you must be around the table where the issues are negotiated, where the issues are discussed. So what we do in terms of our Program 3 is, then we identify, now due to our cost measures and the ceiling that has been placed in, we need to work smarter as well. So we rely much more on the presence of our mission. I'm on slide 19. We rely much more on the presence of our missions. Particularly, we take note of the fact that our ambassador in Vienna has been elected as chairperson for the 1617 of the IAE, for example, so driving our agenda in terms of nuclear and the safety and the uses of nuclear, so in the International Atomic Energy Board. So what we targeted for this year is, we will negotiate and influence outcomes of at least 20 multilateral meetings and processes. So particularly UNGA is a non-negotiable, because it's one of those platforms where our president would then take the stage to make sure that we recommit, for example, the issue of Western Sahara, the reform of the UNSC. So that is a very important platform, and we identify that as one of our platforms that we will look at. The Human Rights Council, we know that we have 3 sessions per annum. The rest of the time, in terms of the Human Rights Council, our ambassador in Geneva will be doing the work, but at least if the council is in session for the opening session, our minister or our deputy minister would usually go in terms of putting South Africa's position forward and so forth. So that is what we're looking at. And then, in order to align, one of the requirements that we had from the DPME was that we need to make sure that what we have on the departmental plan must be aligned what sits in Outcome 11 in the MTSF. Outcome 11, as part of the influential role that we need to play, is that we need to be represented at various bodies. And I know the committee keep on asking us, when we discuss Program 5 and we look at our membership contributions, I know the committee always ask us, so what are we getting back? Do we have South Africans there? So one of our targets is that at least 60 positions must be filled by South Africans on various international multilateral bodies. I need to say that this is by election. So it means that a country will put somebody forward, and then you will lobby so that the other countries will vote for you. So you need to be quite strong, and that's once again where we use our missions to do the lobbying work so that the South African can be elected to then serve on various multilateral bodies. So that is our international cooperation. Then in terms of, if I then move to the targets for continental, which is on page 21, this is then particularly our work on the African agenda that we're doing. And once again, we're looking at, and we have taken note of, yes, it is the second consecutive term that South Africa has been elected to the AUPSC. So what is it that we're doing about it? So that might be one thing that the committee would ask. So do you want to bring us your strategy on the AUPSC to engage? Because what we need to take note of as well is when we table our APP, because that is a public document, you don't want to tell other countries what your foreign policy strategy is. So that's the kind of balance that we maintain. But in the committee, we can have the conversation. So what we're targeting in the APP is that South Africa's participation to negotiate and influence and contribute to democracy, good governance, human rights. We're looking at the various AU structures. So we know that we have two AU summits per year, and then concurrent to that, or just before the AU summits, we usually have the NEPAD summits. We will have the APRM, but we haven't targeted the APRM because the lead department on APRM is the DPSA, for example. But yet, we are continuing to ask for more countries to sign on to the AP.